Someone has said that sarcasm is the lowest form of wit. Which may be so, but I suspect there are times when sarcasm is a legitimate form of self-defense. Certainly the Apostle Paul felt so, because these last four chapters of 2 Corinthians absolutely abound in it. Those of you who have been with us in previous weeks will remember the circumstances. Paul has been put into the unwelcome situation of being on the defensive. A rival party of so-called apostles, what he calls here super-apostles in one verse, you notice. They are conducting a smear campaign to damage his reputation. They said he was incompetent. They said he was unimpressive. Most malicious of all, they said he was conniving, a cynical con man out to feather his own nest at the Corinthians' expense. He's no apostle, they said, he's a fraud. Well, it was understandable that such jibes and allegations hurt Paul deeply. So it's not surprising that in replying to their attack, he sometimes lets his wounded feelings show a bit by the sarcastic edge he gives to his tongue. Indeed, you could say he had no alternative but to respond in such ironic tones, such sarcastic tones. Because, you see, the whole situation at Corinth was crazy with paradox. Here was he, the true apostle of Jesus Christ, being accused by false apostles of being a false apostle himself. You could argue sarcasm was the only appropriate response to such a bitterly ironic situation. And last week, those of you who were here, remember, we saw the first example of it, and we tried to echo Paul's sarcasm in the title we gave to our study. Paul the Ineffectual Wimp, we called it. The ineffectual wimp who conquered continents. Well, this week, and in our next study, which will be after Christmas now, we have two more sections under similar ironic headings to look at. Paul, the amateur loudmouth, who fathered churches, and then Paul, the pathetic clown who glimpsed heaven. And that trilogy together will constitute our study of the profile of an apostle. And in each case, we're going to encounter sarcasm, the lowest form of wit, well, if you say so, but a gentler form of rebuke in many ways than the Corinthians deserved, as we shall see this morning. Let's look then at Paul, the amateur loudmouth who fathered churches. Verse 1, I hope you will put up with a little of my foolishness, but you're already doing that. The sarcasm is there. Right from the beginning, you see. It was wise Solomon who advised us to answer fools according to their folly, and that's really what Paul is doing. It embarrasses him to talk about himself. To be forced into a position where he has to blow his own trumpet, well, frankly, it makes him feel a bit of an idiot. But then he says, since you Corinthians think I'm an idiot anyway, there's nothing much to lose, is there? I'm already the object of your patronizing contempt. So it's not too much to ask you to tolerate a little more of poor old Paul's buffoonery. I could hardly make myself look more ridiculous in your eyes. So at the risk of making you all down in Corinth cripple up with laughter still further, he says, let me tell you exactly how I feel about you. I am jealous for you. Jealous with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, so that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. But I'm afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. Now, those of you again who were here last week, remember that we said then that there's far more to these four chapters than simply a bitter man replying to spiteful personal criticism. If all that had been at stake was Paul's good name, I doubt whether he would have made anything like this amount of fuss about it all. After all, Paul had suffered humiliation in one way or another all his life. A little more from these vitriolic insinuations from the Corinthian so-called apostles wasn't going to make much difference to him. No, there was a much larger issue involved, you see. This particular piece of anti-Pauline propaganda was more than mere anti-Pauline propaganda. These so-called apostles were not just trying to undermine Paul's personal influence. They were trying to undermine the kind of Christianity that Paul stood for. That was a problem. They wanted a religion that was more congenial to the sophisticated Hellenistic culture of their day. It wasn't just Paul's image that they found unacceptable. Christianity itself, they said, needs a facelift. And it's these verses here which make that point clear. Paul is telling us he sees something sinister about this opposition party in Corinth. Something demonic, even, he says. I see them as agents of the devil, craftily seducing a virgin bride of Christ into spiritual adultery, just as Eve was seduced in the Garden of Eden. And says Paul, I'm desperately worried about that. Oh, forgive the fussy anxiety of a silly old man, if that's how you see me. But I feel I have a right to express my concern for you in this matter. After all, I am your spiritual father. That's the implication of verses 2 and 3. I founded the church at Corinth. And as a result of that, I feel a fierce possessiveness about you. I'm jealous for you with a godly jealousy, he says, as any father is towards his daughter. Oh, don't misunderstand me, he says. I'm not one of those awful parents that doesn't want his children to grow up into adult independence. I'm quite willing to give you away. I want to give you away, he says. No one will be prouder than me on your wedding day, for there's no better husband in the world than the one you're betrothed to, Jesus Christ. And when on the last day God says, who gives this church to my son? I want to be able to say, I do. But like any father, I should be utterly ashamed and humiliated should my daughter's chastity be compromised by a flirtation with some other man before that marriage ceremony takes place. And that's precisely what I fear is happening. Verse 4. For if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it easily enough. Do you hear the sarcasm coming back into his voice again there? You have more time these days, he says, it seems, for your spiritual gigolos than for me, your spiritual father. You put up with them, you won't put up with me. Don't you realize that for all their smooth talk, these apostles of yours are leading you astray? They represent a different gospel, a different spirit, an alternative Jesus. Opinions differ about precisely what Paul's implying when he uses that word different. For he uses very similar language in his letter to the Galatians to describe a group of Jewish legalists. They were offering a different gospel too, he says. So some conclude that this Corinthian faction represented the same kind of heresy. And that suggestion gains some support from the implication that Paul makes in verse 22 of this chapter, that his rivals in Corinth were indeed Aramaic-speaking Jews. But it does have to be said, I think, that there's no other evidence of that kind of false teaching in Corinth. Indeed, most of the information we have about Corinth seems to suggest that the Corinthian church leaned rather in the opposite direction, towards Hellenistic licentiousness, rather than Judaistic legalism. Indeed, if this rival party were advocating some clearly identifiable error, like the Galatian heresy, then I would have thought that Paul would have spent some time addressing the theological issues involved, for they were very clear to him. But there is, in fact, nothing in 2 Corinthians, apart from these verses, to suggest that these so-called apostles were not superficially, at any rate, orthodox in doctrine. Indeed, my own suspicion is that very orthodoxy may well have been why Paul saw them as such a subtle threat, and why he felt obliged to reply in the very personal way he does to them. For I doubt whether it was so much a specific false teaching that was the problem with them. It was their methodology. It was their emphases. It was their leadership style. That was the threat from these so-called apostles. They wanted a Christianity, as we've said, that was more congenial to the sophisticated mindset of secular Greek society. And that meant it had to be a Christianity that majored on spiritual strength, not physical weakness, on heavenly triumph, not earthly suffering. In a word, they wanted a Christianity that played down the cross and played up the glory. For it was the glory that was Christianity's selling point, as far as they were concerned. That's why Paul wouldn't do as an apostle. For a start, he was a weak man himself, so they thought. And secondly, he concentrated so much in his preaching on the weakness of Jesus. I am determined to know nothing among you, he said, but Christ crucified. That was Paul's stated philosophy in Corinth. Well, how on earth can he expect to win a Greek audience to his side by such a tasteless message of gory failure? No, they wanted an impressive, dynamic, strong apostle to commend an impressive, dynamic, strong Jesus to a secular culture which had no time for weaklings, still less for victims of crucifixion. And that, you see, is why Paul says they preach a different Jesus. Not so much, I think, because of any particular truth they denied or of any particular heresy they affirmed, or he would have told us about it. But because the image of Christian spirituality they projected was unbalanced. See, the balance of truth is just as important as the truth itself. You are being seduced, he says, not so much by a lie as by a fake, by a regiment of pseudo-apostles whose lives model a pseudo-Christianity. And how are they doing it? Why, he says they're doing it in the same way Eve's serpent did it in the Garden of Eden, by their glib tongues. That's the implication of verses 5 to 6, anyway. I do not think I am in the least inferior to these super apostles. I may not be a trained speaker, but I do have knowledge, he says. It's clear, as we've seen in previous weeks, that one of the sticks Paul's rivals here in Corinth used to beat him with was the lack of refinement in his public speaking. He didn't have the style of a Greek orator. His preaching, though effective in its own way, lacked professionalism, as we would say. Indeed, for the Greek, the mere fact that Paul charged no fees for his preaching could be presented as a damning confession of incompetence, because any professor of rhetoric in the Greek world worth his salt charged his customers. The Greeks didn't have any respect for cheap oratory. I can remember when I lived in Africa, I came across a rather similar prejudice in regard to medicine. You know, the more expensive the medicine that was prescribed by the doctor, the better the doctor was supposed to be. At least that was the way many Africans I met seemed to see it. I can recall several African friends of mine telling me proudly how they had ignored the free drugs from the mission hospital in preference for the very expensive treatment offered by some, I suspect, less well-trained person who'd set himself up in a Harley Street-type practice in the big city. They were sure the more you pay for the medicine, the better it has to be for you. Well, Paul's rivals sought an advantage over him by precisely the same kind of professional one-upmanship. If he was any good, he'd charge a proper fee for his services, they said, like we do. And in a sense, you have to say, Paul had played into their hands in this regard. Because in Acts chapter 18, we are told that in Corinth, he not only didn't charge the Corinthians for his preaching, for part of the time at any rate, he actually did manual work, tent making, to earn his living. Now, in the estimation of a classical Greek, that was absolutely shameful. Only slaves worked with their hands, they said. No, this Paul, for all his dramatic claims, has an inferior, a working-class mind. That's the trouble with Paul. How can he be a Christian leader? He's just an amateur loudmouth, a soapbox preacher. No educated person would waste their time listening to him. Well, says Paul, the sarcasm, you see, coming back into his voice again, I reckon I'm not quite so outclassed by these incomparable arch-apostles of yours as they make out. And I'll give you two reasons why, he says. First, because my preaching has content. not just polish. Verse 6 again. I may not be a trained speaker, but I do have knowledge, he says. Okay, by the standards of Demosthenes, I'm no great orator, but at least I've got something to talk about. I have knowledge. Greek word there that in the circles Paul is addressing almost certainly is loaded with the connotation of supernatural revelation about God. I do have knowledge, he says. And I have made this perfectly clear to you in every way. Or I think possibly better, to every kind of person rather than every way. I suspect that may be a subtle dig at the elitism of Paul's opponents. Their public utterances may have been a dazzling performance, but it left people in ignorance, particularly simple people. As Disraeli said of Gladstone, they were just sophisticated rhetoricians inebriated with the exuberance of their own verbosity. It's a good one, isn't it? Nor, says Paul, my preaching, plain and unvarnished though it may be, has at least the advantage of communicating the truth of God to ordinary people. You know that, you Corinthians, firsthand. Unlike your super apostles, my preaching informs. It doesn't just dazzle. It has content, not just polish. That's the first reason I don't think I'm quite so inferior to them as they make out. And secondly, he says, I think I may not be quite so inferior as they make out because my motives are unselfish, not just mercenary. Verse 7. Was it a sin for me to lower myself in order to elevate you by preaching the gospel of God to you free of charge? There's indignation here, isn't there, as well as sarcasm in his retort. Are you really serious, he says, in suggesting that it was a sign of failure in me that I didn't exploit you financially? I should have passed the collection box more often. You'd have had more respect for me if I'd done that, would you, he said? You silly people. Don't you realize, he says, the only reason I was able to live at Corinth at all was because Christians elsewhere, more thoughtful, more appreciative than you, were voluntarily providing for my needs. Verse 8, I robbed other churches by receiving support from them so as to serve you. How dare you accuse me of being a bungling apprentice in the business of preaching the gospel, he says. The only reason you didn't have to pay is because others valued my ministry so much they were prepared to deprive themselves for your sake. The inexpensiveness of my ministry, this is no mark of amateurism on my part. It's in fact a settled missionary policy of mine. Verse 9, when I was with you and needed something, I was not a burden to anyone. For the brothers who came from Macedonia supplied what I needed. I have kept myself from being a burden to you in any way and will continue to do so. See, as far as Paul was concerned, what would have cheapened the gospel was making people pay for it, not refusing to do so. He would not reduce himself to the level of a professional entertainer. He came as an ambassador of the king, not as some peddler of religious quackery. We know that there were plenty of charlatans in the ancient world in the business of selling religion for money. Greece was full of them. But no one would ever accuse Paul of being one. As surely as the truth of Christ is in me, he says, nobody in the regions of Achaia, of Greece, will stop this boasting of mine. Why? Because I don't love you? God knows I do. I will keep on doing what I am doing, that is, preaching the gospel free of charge, in order to cut the ground from under those who want an opportunity to be considered equal with us in the things they boast about. In other words, if the truth were known, these so-called super apostles would dearly love to be able to claim the same financial independence of you that I can. They're the ones who've got the inferiority complex, not me. And goad me as they may, I'm not going to give up my so-called amateur status, precisely to frustrate them in their ambition to compete with me. If by some extraordinary contortion of logic, they can succeed in presenting my refusal to exploit you as evidence of a lack of loving regard for you all, well, all I can say is God knows they're wrong. In fact, they're more than wrong. They are deliberately misrepresenting me in order to mislead you. Don't you realize, he says, who you are gallivanting with? Super apostles, my foot. The devil, he says, is never more dangerous than when he comes to young Christians like you, dressed in the garb of Christian leadership. Verse 13, for such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, masquerading as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. It's not surprising then if his servants masquerade as servants of righteousness. Their end will be what their actions deserve. At last, the veil of sarcasm and irony is removed, what previously he has hinted at. Now Paul affirms quite unambiguously, these so-called apostles, he says, who are in danger of seducing you from the truth, who complain of my amateurism as a public speaker, they are not just difficult Christians. They're not just immature Christians. They are fake Christians. False apostles, their claims to divine inspiration are spurious. Deceitful workmen, they offer their services to you out of a desire to cheat you. Masquerading as apostles, he says. Their pious external appearance is just a disguise to mask the malevolence of their real intent. You are surprised by this, asks Paul? Well, there's nothing very amazing about people like that. They're just taking a leaf out of the book of their master. Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. It's not surprising if his servants masquerade as servants of righteousness. When Satan desires to injure the church, he invariably dresses himself up as a Christian. For imitation is his stock in trade. Being only an angel, I doubt whether he's got much creative intelligence. I suspect original ideas are beyond the devil. His technique is always to fill the world with counterfeits, therefore. Counterfeits that confuse and mislead people. And that's what's happened to you, Corinthians. You're being so bemused by their rhetoric, so flattered by their attention, you can't see that the kind of Christianity they are cultivating in you is different from the Christianity you received. Like the sirens of Greek mythology, they are luring you away from the path of safety onto the rocks by the simple device of a deceptive, diabolical charm. There are, however, he says, two distinguishing marks the devil can never eradicate from his products. Their moral quality and their final destiny. Their tongues may sound spiritual, but their lives always bear the giveaway trademark, manufactured in hell, and one day that is where they'll go. Their end will be what their actions deserve. Oh, they may call me an amateur loudmouth. In a sense, perhaps I am, he's saying. I have no pretensions to the kind of sophisticated things they admire. But I am genuine, he says. Genuine in the Jesus I portray to you, genuine in the love I share with you. Amateur loudmouth, okay, I accept the jibe. But I am your spiritual father, the spiritual father of dozens of churches, in fact. And I have a right to rebuke you for philandering with these spiritual snakes in the grass. If my sarcasm seems bitter, it is far less bitter than the misery you will bring upon yourselves if you go on jeopardizing your relationship with the real Jesus by these flirtations with fakes. Well, it's a fierce passage, isn't it? Few passages in all Paul's writings are quite, I think, so intense emotionally. And it's a passage with great practical relevance, I think, for many of us. That's why I want us to look at it carefully, rather than to rush on, even if we fall behind in our schedule a little bit. There is a lesson in these words, which I want us all to take on board this morning. And if I was going to express it in a single sentence, it is like this. Beware of Christian gullibility. See again what he says in verses 3 and 4. I am afraid, he says, that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached, you put up with it easily enough. Let me tell you something. In 1822, a man called Smith claimed he received a visitation from an angel. This heavenly emissary, whom he says was called Moroni, directed him to some gold plates hidden on a hill near Palmyra in New York State, so he says. These gold plates, said Smith, were inscribed with ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics, which he was enabled to translate miraculously by means of a specially provided pair of angelic spectacles. On translation, these plates revealed an extraordinary fact about the early history of the American continent, not the least being that America was not discovered by Christopher Columbus, as you and I were taught, but by a Jewish prophet called Lehi, 600 years before Christ. And that Christ himself appeared after his resurrection to the descendants of that ancient Jewish family in the New World. Incredible? I think so. My grandmother used to say, all my eye on Betty Martin. Preposterous hoax. But 3 million adherents of the Church of the Latter-day Saints believe it is absolutely true. The Mormons, as they're called. See, the greatest problem for the Christian church, especially in these modern days we live in, is not, as you might think, the rise of scientific skepticism. It is the growth of public gullibility. Chesterton said, when people abandon the truth, they don't believe in nothing, they believe in anything. And there are thousands of cults and sects in our world today, many of them, one would have thought, straining the credulity of simple Simon by their bizarre and fantastic speculations. And yet all of them, by their numerical success, proving the accuracy of Chesterton's assertion. People will believe in anything. The church does not have to really worry seriously about atheism, in my view. That is an ephemeral superstition. It's never seriously threatened the essential religious consciousness of the world. Marxism sustains whatever limited success it's had in that direction only by vicious policies of repression on the church and other religious groups. No, the real danger is not unbelief, but wrong belief. Not skepticism, but superstition. Not irreligion, but gullibility. Not the doubter, but the deceiver. Again and again, church history has proven this true. It is not external assaults on Christianity by its ideological or philosophical or religious rivals that represent the most serious threat to its survival. It is the subtle infiltration of saboteurs who exploit the gullibility of Christian people. They're the ones who do the damage. Saboteurs who as often as not present themselves as Christian ministers and who succeed in duping the sheep by their false claims to spiritual authority. It's not as if we haven't been warned about this. Paul told the elders of the church in Ephesus when he said goodbye to them in Acts 20 that such savage predators would arise from your own number. He says, out of the eldership of the church you will find such people coming, distorting the truth, drawing away disciples after them. Jesus spoke too of men who would be thought prophets, but who would be false prophets, who would come dressed in sheep's clothing, but he said would be inwardly wolves. The warnings are there. But the devil is clever, you see. And as the Corinthians found, the impersonation is good. The seduction is subtle. And Christians? Christians are unbelievably credulous. They find it so hard to believe that anybody who sounds so spiritual and looks so charming could possibly be an agent of the evil one. That's why I say, beware of Christian gullibility. Harmless as doves we may have to be, but wise as serpents too. For it is a wily serpent we have to fight. Let me point out to you a few observations then from this passage in 2 Corinthians 11 that may make us a little less gullible about demonic impersonations in the church of our day, the church of the 20th century. The first observation I make is this. Don't be fooled by words. It's quite clear Paul's rivals had rhetoric on their side, isn't it? But then the devil often does, you know. Clever words are his stock in trade. Often they will be flattering words. He will pamper our intellectual pride, making us feel how very exciting it is to listen to such a gifted and highly qualified exponent of avant-garde theology. What on earth did I ever see in that old-fashioned conservative theology I used to believe in? Clearly these new ideas are what intelligent Christians in the modern world are talking about. And by listening to this wonderful person, I can join their elevated ranks. Oh, I'm pretty sure that kind of intellectual elitism was in the appeal of Paul's rivals at Corinth. It's certainly there in many common rooms in Cambridge today. Sometimes the devil's words will be distorted words. I mean by that he will use the vocabulary of biblical Christianity, but as he uses it, he will subtly redefine his terms so that the biblical words no longer convey their biblical meaning. Clearly this was going on in Corinth, for in verse 4 we're told so. These false apostles talked about the Spirit, the Gospel, Jesus, cardinal words in Christian vocabulary. But the content they put into these words was not the same. It was a different gospel, a different Spirit, a different Jesus. And so they confused the Corinthians, you see, communicating falsehood behind a facade of orthodoxy. That is why, of course, the church, over the course of history, has had to refine her creeds. In the days of the primitive church, it was sufficient simply to say, Jesus is Lord. Such a confession was unambiguously Christian. But then along came the deceiver, preaching a different Jesus. And then it was no longer enough simply to say, Jesus is Lord, because you had to answer the question, well, which Jesus do you mean? And as errors of distortion became more subtle, so the creeds had to become more subtle, more developed. In fact, I'm afraid it is true that no matter how precise you make your statement of faith, there will always be some false teacher around who will construe a way in which he can say it and mean something different by it. It is the nature of words. So don't be deceived by distorted words. Orthodox language can mask demonic lies. There are plenty of examples of that in the church today. But I think the chief lesson regarding words from this Corinthian problem is that we're not to be fooled by mere words. See, what these pseudo-apostles demonstrate more clearly perhaps than anything else is that you do not need to be an outspoken heretic to be false to the gospel. If my suspicions are correct, the doctrinal credentials of these men was unimpeachable. It wasn't possible to tie down their error in terms of creedal propositions they affirmed or denied, no matter how sophisticated or subtle you made those creeds. For what was wrong about them was that they had surrendered to a secular mood in their culture. And as a result, their Christian spirituality was astray. It showed in their methodology. Paul could see it there, the way they did their evangelism. It showed in their emphases in their preaching. It showed in their style of leadership. It was, as we say, unbalanced, more than heretical. They played down the cross, they played up the glory. But for Paul, such unbalance was still enough to put them into the devil's camp. For it was an unbalance born of worldliness. Worldliness, though it often leads to false teaching, is not the same as false teaching. Worldliness, in fact, can and often does exist in churches which are genuinely orthodox in their belief. Because worldliness is not the result of having no cross in your theology. It's the result of not being prepared to have a cross in your life. And that, as we shall see in our next study, was the real problem with these false apostles. Mere words aren't enough. A Christian leader can be using all the right words and even mean the right things by those words, but still be communicating a different Jesus because his lifestyle speaks louder than what he's saying with his lips. Their end will be what their actions deserve, says Paul, not their words. So beware of mere words. There is such a thing as non-verbal communication. And it can be just as misleading as the verbal kind, perhaps more so. If you want to avoid the perils, then, of Christian gullibility, here's the first lesson to learn from this passage. Don't be fooled by words. Flattering words. Distorted words. Mere words. The second lesson I draw out for you this morning from this passage, if you want to avoid Christian gullibility, is this. Don't be naive about money. Was it a sin for me to lower myself in order to elevate you by preaching the gospel of God to you free of charge? Asks Paul. See, it's quite clear Paul regarded the way his evangelistic work was financed was enormously important. He took great pains to maintain a firm policy in this matter. I think there are a couple of distinct reasons for this. First, because he knows that money can corrupt the preacher. Indeed, I don't think it's too cynical to say, if you want to identify questionable sects and groups in the Christian world, look at their accounts. See where the money comes from and where it goes to. Don't be surprised if you get a nasty shock or two. For successful religion is big business, and there are plenty in the world of the 20th century, as there were in the first century, who are willing to exploit the religious market. One reason, quite clearly, Paul refused to take money from the Corinthians was because he was determined not to be categorized with such peddlers of pop religion. It was important to the dignity of his apostolic office that the Corinthians should see him as somebody who offered the gospel to them without motives of personal financial gain. He was a preacher, not a salesman. And he wanted that absolutely clear to them. I don't misunderstand Paul. He was willing to accept financial support for his ministry, wasn't he? He says so in verse 9. I was not a burden to anyone. The brothers who came from Macedonia supplied what I needed. Paul was happy to accept financial support for his ministry. What he was not prepared to accept was fees for evangelistic services rendered. For such fees can corrupt the preacher. But in addition to that, such money can change the way people perceive the preacher. I remember an experience that brought this home to me very early in my Christian life. I was at a seaside mission, a Scripture Union mission on the Suffolk coast, and one afternoon I stopped to watch a Punch and Judy show on the beach. It was quite a good show, and a fine crowd had gathered to watch. It was a sunny day. At the end of the show, the puppeteer came round asking for contributions. You know how they do. I remember very clearly how startled I was to notice the box he was shaking to receive people's monetary gifts, because it was absolutely identical to the offering boxes we used in my home church. Could there be a connection, I suddenly thought to myself? Could it be that some in my home church put money in the offering box with the same kind of attitude that this Punch and Judy man's audience were putting money into his box? As a tribute to the quality of his performance? As a payment for a half an hour's good entertainment? As a gesture of charity to an impecunious street artist? God forbid. If any one of you has contributed in that kind of way, with that kind of thought in your mind to this morning's offerings, I do beg you, don't put another penny in till you've learned to offer your money to God as an act of worship. You are not my clients. Paul would rather maintain his amateur status than become a professional for precisely this reason. He didn't want people thinking of him or themselves as his clients. Those of you here who want to preach, I tell you this, if you are not willing to preach for nothing, don't preach at all. For once you see preaching as a, quote, professional career, You are halfway to not being a preacher anymore, but just a puppeteer. A puppeteer who will say the kind of things that keep the cash till ringing, keep the audience happy. Now, don't be naive about money. It can corrupt preachers, and it can corrupt their congregations too. It's most important. Money is handled right in the church. And the third lesson, final lesson I would give you from this passage, if you want to avoid Christian gullibility, is this. Don't be sentimental about tolerance. Look again at verse 13. Such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, masquerading as apostles of Christ. Now you may feel those words are unnecessarily severe. Bigoted even. After all, anyone can make a mistake. A pedantic theologian could identify at least a dozen heretical statements in the average Christian prayer meeting. Surely Paul is not showing much Christian love in stigmatizing these rivals of his in this dreadful way, is he? Well, if that's how you feel about it, if that thought of bigotry is hovering at the back of your mind, I think it behoves us to ask ourselves the question, well then, what are the limits of my Christian tolerance? Have I got any? Paul, you see, was persuaded that these men were not innocently deluded Christian brothers and sisters. They were not even representatives of a different Christian tradition whose insights could enrich his. These men were agents of the devil. Their invasion of Corinth was part of a demonic plot to destroy the church, to subvert the church by sabotage. What kind of people do you believe might belong to that kind of category today? Or in complaining of Paul's bigotry, are we really saying we don't believe any such category of demonic infiltration really exists? Are we saying that Paul is exaggerating the spiritual danger in which the church lies? Well, if that is our attitude, I have to tell you, I believe that when you speak of Christian love, you might be more accurate if you spoke rather of fatuous sentimentality. Because that is what you're exhibiting. Sentimentality is undiscriminating love, and Christian love cannot be that. Real Christian tolerance is a virtue born of a strong conviction of the truth, which doesn't feel threatened by contradiction, and which is therefore quietly confident of its own final vindication. Modern humanistic tolerance is a vice born of mass indecision about the truth, which dare not confess any particular belief for fear of being accused of narrow-mindedness. George Mikes, in his book How to Be an Alien, puts it well. It is today, he says, bad manners to assert anything confidently. It may be your personal view that 2 and 2 makes 4. But you must not state it in a self-assured way, because this is a democratic country and others may be of a different opinion. And he's mocking, of course. Don't you see the element of truth in that? Pluralistic confusion has nothing to do with tolerance at all, still less with the strong virtue of Christian love. Paul loved these Corinthians. He tells us so in verse 11. But that didn't stop him identifying the servants of Satan in their midst and denouncing them. On the contrary, it was his love for them that demanded such a denunciation. I am jealous for you, he says, with a godly jealousy. This father in Christ could not stand idly by and watch his daughter being seduced without protest. There were limits to his tolerance. There must be limits to our tolerance, too. It will not do to be sentimental about the subject. Gresham Machen was right when some years ago he said, the most important things are not the things about which men are agreed, but those for which men will fight. Well, undoubtedly it's possible to fight over trivia, and the church has suffered such unnecessary belligerence, I know. But it's a far greater mistake to refuse to fight at all. Be a pacifist about nuclear weapons if you wish, but please don't be passive about the truth. There are limits to tolerance. We are not in the kind of world humanistic optimism wants us to believe. All men are not struggling unitedly after the truth. There is a liar abroad with a spiritual interest in propagating untruth. Resist him, says the New Testament. Resist him firm in your faith. Don't be passive about the truth. They called Paul an amateur loudmouth. In a sense, that's all he was. But he fathered churches, and I suggest to you he fathered them because he had convictions. Convictions he was willing to fight for. Convictions he was not prepared to see denied. He fathered churches because, man of love though he was, there were limits to his Christian tolerance. And in a world like ours, where bishops deny the Apostles' Creed, where ecumenical councils mouth Marxist slogans, where TV evangelists become millionaires, where pseudo-Christian cults often claim more adherents than mainstream Christian denominations, well, then it behoves us all not to be fooled by words, not to be naive about money, not to be sentimental about tolerance, and above all, not to be gullible. Let's pray together.